Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's proposed overhaul of the tax code that White House economic advisor Gary Cohn is insisting will not benefit the wealthy, while other experts insist the opposite is true. And speak with Bruce Bartlett, who served as a senior policy advisor in the Reagan White House and as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy in George H.W. Bush's Treasury Department. He joins us to discuss his article at the Washington Post, "I Helped Create the GOP Tax Myth, Trump is Wrong, Tax Cuts Don't Equal Growth," and how the Republicans are going to push through a tax bill in the same way they tried to repeal Obamacare by excluding the Democrats, hiding the details, and steamrolling the experts and analysts to get tax cuts for the rich passed before the public finds out later that they have to pay for them and that the promises made to benefit middle class and working Americans were yet another lie. Then we'll examine Trump's latest racist outburst from the safe confines of his sycophantic softball news outlet, Fox and Friends, where the president revived his phony fight with the NFL by dog-whistling that the all-white NFL owners are going along with the protests by the mostly black players because they are being intimidated by them, claiming NFL owners are afraid of their players. David Steele, who writes about the NFL for Sporting News as a columnist and is the co-author of Olympic champion Tommy Smith's autobiography, Silent Gesture, joins us to discuss Trump's unmistakably racist inference and cheap exploitation of patriotism when the NFL owners and players are linking arms in a statement of unity as their president does everything he can to encourage division and fan hatred across the United States of America. Then finally, we'll look into the desperate and perhaps dangerous measures Spain's conservative government is resorting to in an effort to thwart and frustrate Sunday's referendum in Catalonia. Becca Seguin, a professor of Iberian Studies at Johns Hopkins University and co-author of an article at The Nation, "Have Spain and Catalonia Reached a Point of No Return?" joins us to discuss the Madrid government's deployment of thousands of riot police to Barcelona and threats to fine and jail secessionist politicians while shutting down polling places and arresting those printing ballots. And joining us now is Bruce Bartlett, who served as senior policy analyst in the White House during the Reagan administration and was Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the Treasury Department in the George H.W. Bush administration. He also was a columnist for Forbes and has written for the economics blog at the New York Times, a New York Times best-selling author. His books include The Benefit and the Burden, Tax Reform, Why We Need It and What It Will Take, and The Truth Matters, A Citizen's Guide to Separating Facts from Lies and Stopping Fake News in Its Tracks. He also has an article at the Washington Post, "I Helped Create the GOP Tax Myth, Trump is Wrong, Tax Cuts Don't Equal Growth." Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Bartlett.
Happy to be here.
And I wanted to start out by asking you, since you worked at a high level both in the Reagan White House and in the George H.W. Bush Treasury Department, so far the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, has come out initially with a two-page tax reform proposal, and now I believe the second round is 8 pages.
I think it's 9, but it's really large type.
Well, I take it you think they're a little thin on details.
A little thin, yes.
So what is this, amateurism or arrogance?
I think it's both. I think that it's really a replay of the health care debate. Trump came into office thinking foolishly that his party had been doing a lot of work on coming up with a replacement for Obamacare, and I think he has said publicly he literally thought he would have a repeal bill on his desk the day he took the oath of office. And as we now know, and has been revealed by an interview with Lindsey Graham yesterday, they didn't do anything. They just planned on repealing Obamacare and replacing it with absolutely nothing. And I think that the similar sort of slipshod method of policymaking is going on in the tax area as well. I think Trump and the other Republicans think, well, cutting taxes is easy. Let's just lie to people and say we're going to do tax reform, but actually we're just going to slash taxes for the ultra wealthy and lie to everybody saying that no, we're not. We're really helping the middle class, and we'll just do this, and our contributors will all be happy, and we'll lie to people about how it'll raise growth. And then then next year, when it's clear that revenues are collapsing, we'll slash spending for the poor. That's their playbook.
So they haven't gotten away with the health care repeal and replace because people have woken up.
Not yet, but they haven't given up either.
No, that's true. But I think people did wake up to what was in these bills, as thin as they were, and they were rushed through. And as you know, they were trying to beat the clock with the CBO markup scoring.
But as you know, we were only one vote away in the Senate from success.
Right.
And it was quite a miracle that Senator McCain came to his senses and put the coup de grace on this. And that legislation passed the House. We were, you know, very, very, very close to having a complete and total disaster for our health care system. And I think we're very close to a complete and total disaster for our tax system as well.
So will it follow the same pattern where the Democrats are cut out, where we don't learn about it until the last minute, just before they take a vote? Is that going to be the same MO for tax?
It certainly looks that way. There's no evidence whatsoever that they are reaching out to the Democrats. And it's very, very hard to see how the Republican goals of what they want to accomplish in the tax area are even remotely reconcilable to those of what the Democrats would demand. So I really think they have no choice but to do it their own way, even though I'm pretty sure it's not going to work and will end in disaster.
And again, I'm speaking with Bruce Bartlett, who served as a senior policy analyst in the White House during the Reagan administration and was Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the Treasury Department in the George H.W. Bush administration. He's also has authored a column for Forbes and was written for the Economics blog at the New York Times. And he's a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Benefit and the Burden, Tax Reform, Why We Need It and What It Will Take, and The Truth Matters, A Citizen's Guide to Separating Facts from Lies and Stopping Fake News in Its Tracks. And he has an article at the Washington Post, I helped create the GOP tax myth. Trump is wrong. Tax cuts don't equal growth. So let's get to that, and because obviously they're trucking out that same sort of trickle-down argument that if you cut taxes, the economy will suddenly take off. Describe how you created that myth and subsequently have repudiated it.
Well, I haven't repudiated what I did in the past. I think the Reagan tax cut was a good, although not necessarily important, element of the economy of the 80s. But I do believe that under current circumstances, there's simply no case for a tax cut at all. Now, you have to remember that in the 1970s, we had high inflation, and one of the effects of inflation at that time was to push people into higher tax brackets. So if you didn't cut taxes, you had a large automatic tax increase going on. Plus, tax rates were very significantly higher for all Americans, and the top rate went up to 70%. I think it was a good idea to bring that down to 50%, but I think the benefits of going from 39.6% where it is now to 35%, as Trump proposes, would be extremely modest if there was any effect at all.
Well, that's sort of going back to what it was before Obama raised it, right, in 2013.
That's right. The tax rate was reduced. It was reduced ultimately to 28% in the Tax Reform Act of 1986, mm-hmm. and then it was raised to 39.6% in 1993 by Bill Clinton. Now, interestingly, as soon as that tax increase took effect, the economy boomed. I mean, most of us are old enough to remember the 90s, and that was the most prosperous decade we've had in recent memory. and it was predicated on a tax increase, whereas the growth in the 1980s was actually less in the aggregate than it was in the 1970s or the 1990s. But the 2000s, under George W. Bush, was absolutely the worst decade since the 1930s.
But Bernie Sanders, for example, ran on the platform of inequality, and the statistics are pretty compelling, aren't they? I mean, I don't know how much it has affected the debate, and certainly it surely has to be a subtext in tax reform. In other words, we're going further into conditions that will create more inequality. Is that, that's what it comes down to, doesn't it?
Well, yes. I think the problem of automation will tend in the future to make income inequality worse. We're getting rid of the jobs that the people at the low end, people with little education, are able to do. Those tend to be repetitive sorts of jobs that are easily replaced by robotics. Now, one of the problems nobody talks about is that people at the low end tend to spend per capita more than people at the top. That is, if you're poor, you're going to spend from, you're probably living from hand to mouth. If you get an extra $10, you're going to go out and spend it. But if you give more money to people like Donald Trump, he already owns a gold toilet. What more could he possibly spend money on if you, even if you gave him a big tax cut, he's not going to do anything different as far as spending is concerned than he's doing right now. So as we shift income upwards, we lose a very important element of what drives the economy, which is spending. And that's just a simple macroeconomic reason why we need to be concerned about income inequality. Our growth really depends on it.
So, in other words, wealthy people can't buy 100 cars. They can only buy 2 or 3. They can't go to 100 restaurants every night, etc. I get that argument, but what are they doing with their money, and why do they want more? Are they hoarding? What is the answer?
Well, they're investing it. I mean, they don't have their money just sitting around in piles like Scrooge McDuck. Right. But if you look at the corporate data, which we can get very easily from the Federal Reserve, corporations are sitting on literally trillions of dollars of idle funds that they are neither paying out to shareholders nor using for investment. And this is something that's been going on for some years that economists have been complaining about, but it's certainly not because of taxes that they're not spending. They already have the money. So we have a problem here.
Well, is there a creative solution? Because clearly just cutting taxes to the rich, we've been there, done that, it doesn't work. It's a fraudulent argument. Where's the creative argument to unlock all of this economic potential that's sitting idle?
Well, ironically, Donald Trump told us the answer, which is we need a big infrastructure program. We need to be doing, I mean, even forget about the transportation system. Let's look at all the damage that we had just recently to Texas, Florida, Puerto Rico. This is perfectly consistent with the idea that climate change is making storms worse. I mean, if the temperature is warmer, you're going to have more evaporation, and it's going to have to come down somewhere. And so we should be building seawalls across our vulnerable beach areas and low-lying coastal areas. We need to be doing all kinds of things to prepare for climate change. That alone would cost trillions of dollars, and we can pay for it by having a carbon tax, which would help reduce the factors that cause climate change. That's a win-win situation. So that's what I would do if I had, you know, the power to do it.
And is there a way that Americans can save apart from being on the stock exchange, in the stock market, the 401ks, etc.? In other words, in the idea of of rebuilding America, is there a kind of World War II savings bond aspect to that that would make sense?
It's really not necessary. All mm-hmm. you have to do is look at the interest rates that the people can get on saving right now. It's very, very low.
That's what I mean.
We don't need more saving. What we need is more spending.
I see.
And since we individuals can't really do more unless we raise their income somehow, but the best way to raise their income is to put them to work. The government needs to hire people, give them jobs, pay them wages. This will cause wages in general to rise, and that will give everybody a pay raise.
So in the short term, then, this is the obvious solution, not that anybody's talking about it. The infrastructure, which all of the pundits say is the most doable thing that Trump could have embraced, he hasn't embraced yet. But just in closing, let's go back to the bigger issue of whether jobs will become obsolete in the future through robotics, etc. That requires even more creativity, doesn't it, in terms of a solution?
Yes, that's right. But it is a fairly long-term problem. But there are many economists who are worried about a problem called secular stagnation, which means that we're stuck in a low-growth environment. They're debating amongst themselves as to what to actually do about it. But again, this is an argument for saying that nothing we can do as a gimmick with the tax system is very likely to change the trajectory we're on. We have to do something much bigger and more fundamental. We need to look back to the history of the 1930s, really, to guide us for the future.
Well, Bruce Bartlett, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate the conversation.
Okay.
And again, I've been speaking with Bruce Bartlett, who served as a senior policy analyst in the White House during the Reagan administration and was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Economic Policy at the Treasury Department in the George H.W. Bush administration. He has also authored a column for Forbes and has written for the Economics blog at the New York Times. He's a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Benefit and Burden, Tax Reform, Why We Need It and What It Will Take, and The Truth Matters, A Citizen's Guide to Separating Facts from Lies and Stopping Fake News in Its Tracks. And he has an article at the Washington Post, I Helped Create the GOP Tax Myth, Trump is Wrong, Tax Cuts Don't Equal Growth. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining Trump's latest racist outbursts where he claimed NFL owners are afraid of their players. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Steele, who writes about the NFL for Sporting News as a columnist. He has previously written for the Baltimore Sun, the San Francisco Chronicle, and Newsday, and he's the co-author of Olympic champion Tommy Smith's autobiography, Silent Gesture. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Steele.
Thank you very much for having me.
And the silent gesture we're referring to, was that the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City?
It was. It was Tommy Smith's protest on the victory stand with John Carlos raising their hand during the national anthem, raising their fist, rather. We're
right.
Very clear about that,
right.
Raising their fist, yeah.
And it was considered a black power gesture.
That's correct, yeah.
Right.
And that's exactly how everybody responded to it and reacted to it at the time.
Right, and here we have so many, decades later, the same thing's happening. But this is a ginned-up, phony controversy, at least in my opinion, David. I think President Trump is simply using all of the means of distractions he can muster on a daily basis to distract his base from the fact that he's a completely incompetent president and can't get anything done and doesn't know what he's doing. So he gins up these controversies, like throwing red meat to his base. He again did it. Fox News aired his interview today where he said, I'll quote him, "I have so many friends that are owners, NFL owners he's talking about, and they're in a box. I mean, I've spoken to a couple of them and they say, we're in a situation where we need to do something. I think they're afraid of their players, if you want to know the truth, and I think it's disgraceful." So here he is picking the scab again. He wants this. He wants us all to be talking about NFL players taking their knees and how this is unpatriotic, as opposed to how he's mishandling Puerto Rico, for example.
Yeah, and any number of things, but yeah, Puerto Rico is right at the top of the list. But yeah, he's there. This is another. He's up to ante one more time. He's raised it another level. It's hard to believe that it hasn't even been a full week since he just sort of came out of nowhere during, you know, what again was. It started at an event, an affair that was just something that he shouldn't even have been bothering himself with. You know, he's an acting president with crisis swirling all around him. He's still dealing with the old hurricanes that hit the continental U.S., dealing with the new one hitting that was destroying Puerto Rico, all the scandals in his administration. And he goes off and, as he always does, goes onto a campaign speech and just lobs this NFL accusation into the middle of it and does it as crudely as possible, does it to fire up the crowd to make for a, you know, nice, a big television moment and to draw another us versus them line, with the people, in this country. And he did it right in the middle of, you know, the football season. And he also did it during a time where the protests themselves that had been taking place had sort of, you know, had sort of reached their own level. The players who had decided to protest were doing what they were doing. Others were doing things behind the scenes. You know, there was still discussion about whether Colin Kaepernick would even be allowed to play this year, whether any team would reach out. And even that has been totally obliterated in all of this, just the fact that he's being blackballed by the same owners that he's embracing right now. But, yeah, it's a tactic that everybody's familiar with, and he's pushed all the buttons that everybody's familiar with him pushing. And they're reacting much in the ways that he did, except that he's probably got some people who have rallied against him in ways that maybe he didn't necessarily didn't expect.
But surely when he's making this statement that NFL owners are afraid of their players, we know that NFL owners are predominantly white and that the prominent protesters amongst the players are predominantly black. So how can this not be racist? I mean, how do you see it?
It's completely racist, 100%. I mean, it's and what's most racist about it is the constant denial by him, by his supporters, inside and out of sports, you know, of any racial component to any of this. And, you know, and this is something that's been discussed constantly, that, you know, it's always hidden under a declaration of patriotism, love for the flag, love for your country, which again is divisive in itself, and it's an old tactic. You know, I mean, he's dusting off stuff from the 60s, the 50s, the 30s, you know, the entire Jim Crow era of this country. Whenever there's any sort of move by people of color, mainly by black people, to assert their rights, and he grabbed exactly what he needed to grab to drive up his base, which is this white base of voters and supporters who he needs by his side because everything is closing in on him. But yeah, to pick at, you know, professional athletes to tap into every stereotype they possibly could, you know, even on a football level, it obscures the fact that football players by and large in the NFL are the least powerful, the most powerless of professional athletes compared to what the owners are able to do to them. But that's all being forgotten because he's pushing all the typical stereotype labeling buttons that his fan base loves to push.
And again, I'm speaking with David Steele, who writes about the NFL for Sporting News as a columnist, and he's previously written for the Baltimore Sun, San Francisco Chronicle, and Newsday, and he's the co-author of Olympic champion Tommy Smith's autobiography, Silent Gesture. So expand on that, if you will, David, in terms of the players being powerless and the owners of the NFL being powerful. Because what Trump is signaling in this crude dog whistle way to his white angry followers, he's basically signaling that these wealthy NFL players who are being paid a lot of money for the privilege, I think he said, of being paid, I can't remember, that was the word he used actually, pretty clear to me that what he's signaling is that they just should shut the hell up and they're overpaid and they should be grateful.
Yeah, and that's sort of the underlying theme of everything he's done, but it, this sort of accentuates it, that it, one, anybody who's against him, and two, anybody of color who's against him, in any member of the group that he has been targeting literally since the day he announced his candidacy, you know, and back in 2015, needs to shut up and needs to embrace his image of America, which does not include people of color. And there's always been, I mean, historically and certainly throughout this campaign, this image he's been projecting of this big black boogeyman that's out to come and get real Americans, steal their jobs, steal their money, steal their place in the world. He painted this picture of this bleak urban dystopian landscape that's being hounded by black criminals, you know, throughout his campaign. And it's the same imagery he's drawing on now, that, you know, they're not, you know, this skilled group of athletes who are doing, that are tapping into their intelligence and their influence and their platform to change something significant in this, in this country's system and its structure. It's like these are people who are coming to get you. They're abusing their privilege. You know, they're big, they're black, they're scary. They should be in jail. That's where they would be if they weren't playing football. You should be as scared of them as you would be any quote unquote thug on the corner. And these poor, you know, these poor white millionaires are living in fear of them and are being intimidated by them, literally by the act of kneeling down before a football game. And that's literally the image that he's taken. So that's the image that they're playing on, is that even by not speaking a word and just by taking a knee during a portion of the game where literally nobody's playing, you know, he's developed this image of them being the most terrifying group of people in the world. And the people who actually control their every movement and their livelihoods and put their lives at risk every single week, in terms of, you know, and that being the owners putting the players' lives at risk in order to, you know, make money off of them, are turned into the victims. And the players who are really the victims of the owners' greed and excesses are actually the aggressors.
Well, of course, in this exaggerated macho way that he has, obviously, he's ultimately a very insecure man, but he does show off this macho bravado. And he also, in his original rant against the NFL and Colin Kaepernick, he didn't name him, but clearly it was directed at Colin Kaepernick, that he basically thinks that the game itself has gone too soft. And he obviously doesn't know about the CTE that's happening all over the place from these players. So that's the part of it that I find extraordinary, is that on top of all everything else, he's also denying that the real controversy in NFL, which is about brain damage. Now, what's your sense then of, has Trump been successful, though, in distracting the original purpose of Colin Kaepernick's taking a knee, which was to protest police brutality, particularly directed against the black community? In other words, what he's done is he switched from a real investigation that's needed and a real debate, a national debate that's required, to this phony debate about patriotism.
Yeah, absolutely. He has hijacked the message completely. And in that sense, he's done the owners who he's throwing his support behind a big favor. And of course, you have to remember that, you know, there are, you know, at least six owners who have given a minimum of $1 million to him in campaign and inauguration contributions. And there are several others who have supported him in various other ways and who are, they're his kind of people when it comes right down to it. They are from his class. They are his target audience. And they think like he does. And in that specific instance, interestingly enough, you know, they share the same ideas when it comes to, you know, abusing the players and not handling, you know, the entire issue of CTE and brain trauma the way that they should be in a manner that actually benefits the players. So that taps into it as well. And it taps into every fan that basically chooses team and owner and franchise and what they term as loyalty over the players as individual people. So, again, you know, everyone sort of falls in line. They sort of all fit into the boxes that have sort of been prescribed for them long ago. The fact is now that it's just on a much, much bigger stage. I mean, it's sort of operating on a smaller stage, just among the people who are watching the NFL closely. Now, people who don't particularly care about the NFL have sworn that they will never support the league again, you know, and it's all based on what the president has, you know, turned into his main priority, which is, here's my opportunity to take a stand against these rich, spoiled, entitled black people whose real purpose is to entertain us and to keep his mouth and to keep their mouths shut.
Well, what, of course, again, is forgotten is the purpose of Colin Kaepernick's protest. And I've been following the St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporting. They've done really excellent reporting on the race riots that have taken place there since the acquittal of a white police officer for shooting a black man. And as we know, there's a history of that in with Ferguson, etc. And the reporting is extraordinary, how brutal the police are, how thug-like and mob-like, you know, they're chanting, we're going to take the streets, we own the streets, they're, you know, acting like thugs, rounding up all kinds of people, including Air Force officers, and undercover St. Louis policeman was beaten up by them as well. They do this thing called kettling. Very good reporting, and it's just so obvious that there is an issue in this country that Kaepernick is identifying. It's an important one, and that is police brutality. And by the way, President Trump recently encouraged the police to rough up suspects, and this led to a rebuke from the head of the Drug Enforcement Administration, who's just quit in protest, saying that Donald Trump doesn't have respect for the law. So isn't that what we should be talking about?
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And what's become fascinating about that from both a football level and sort of a national level is when the league, either officially or unofficially, you know, either on the books or off the books, decided that Colin Kaepernick was not going to play in the league this year, they concocted a pretty wide-ranging and complex cover story that a lot of people sort of followed along with that basically you know, blame Kaepernick himself, you know, disparaged him as a player, disparaged his cause, twisted his words, either over or under amplified his actions, you know, found a bunch of, you know, straw men here and there to use as justifications for not signing him. And they were doing this largely without the president being involved at all. Now, there had been reporting in the beginning of the football season that one of the team's fears in signing Kaepernick was literally this exact backlash for publicly from Donald Trump. He made a comment very early after his inauguration about how glad he was at one of his, you know, campaign stops again, how glad he was that they kept Colin Kaepernick out of the league and that he doesn't deserve to be back in, and that just encouraged teams not to sign him. Then he did make the statement in front of the police officers in Long Island about, you know, encouraging police brutality. Kaepernick has continued to stay on message. The players who have joined him, which was obviously a smaller group than last week, continue to stay on message. But since Donald Trump brought it to a bigger stage, him, the owners, and most of the fans have gone into overdrive to water it down. And that's why, starting with the games this evening, in fact, because there's a Thursday night game between the Bears and the Packers, they're going to be doing everything as a team. They're going to be linking arms. They're going to be bringing fans into it. The theme is going to be unity, togetherness, and not being divided. And with every gesture like that, in which individuals are unable to make their own decisions, the further they're going to get from the original point of his Colin Kaepernick's protest and all the other players' protests, so that what they're going to be really protesting nothing. I mean, to say unity is really kind of an empty phrase, an empty gesture. It's a lot emptier than saying stop police brutality. So on several levels, they contributed to diluting it, but the biggest contributing factor, obviously, was this obsession by Donald Trump this past week.
Right, but I think the person who's dividing this country and doing so, I think, dangerously and continuing to do so, and is clearly, I don't think there's a strategy behind it. I think this is a desperate man who may well be losing his marbles, but or have already lost his marbles. But that's
I think you make a great point. I apologize for interrupting, but that is such an excellent point, because there have been people who have continued to say, "What a brilliant strategy this is! What he's, what a clever, way that he has done this to do this and that." You know, I'm still convinced that what he blurted out in front of that crowd in Alabama last week was just him talking off the cuff like he's done, you know, ever since becoming president, ever since running for office, and ever since he's been a part of public life. I mean, he's rash, he's irrational, he has no impulse control, he talks off the top of his head, and he lets his most ignorant impulses come to the forefront. And one of his most ignorant impulses all is to be racist. So everything is sort of flowered off of that, and I think everybody needs to be reminded of that as often as possible.
So just going forward, in closing, David Steele, where is this going to continue? Because it seems to me that Trump is not, he's handing his supporters a difficult choice. You know, either you can be racist or you can have your football, but you can't have both. And I think that at the end of the day, the football's going to win out. What's your sense?
Yeah, I agree. I think that across the board, football in the NFL is still such a powerful force that it's going to end up being the focus by the fans, by the players, by the owners, and eventually by the White House as well. You know, they'll move on to some other fad. Something else is going to distract them that he'll use to distract the rest of the country. He's done it with TV anchors, with broadcasters, with just selected targets that he all of a sudden gets an obsession about that he can't let go of for several days. They'll continue to play in the NFL. And once the playoffs roll around, fans are going to be caring more about who wins and loses and who's going to the Super Bowl than they will about which members of the teams are kneeling and who's sitting and who's linking arms. And, you know, it'll all blow over. There's still going to be a lot of hard feelings by a lot of people, and people are going to be reminded once again in due time that Colin Kaepernick was blackballed by the owners for his social beliefs. But in terms of it being a controversy of this magnitude, I think it's going to end up sort of returning to its normal level. And unfortunately, the thing about that is that the way that Trump conducts himself, insanity is the normal level. So there's just going to be an element of insanity in everything that touches him. So the everything that involves football and any discussion of police brutality or any other injustice that athletes talk about is going to have that element of chaos involved in it. And that's what everything is left with whenever he gets involved.
Well, David Steele, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Steele, who writes about the NFL for Sporting News as a columnist, and he previously written for the Baltimore Sun and the San Francisco Chronicle and Newsday, and he's the co-author of Olympic champion Tommy Smith's autobiography, Silent Gesture. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the desperate and perhaps dangerous measures Spain's conservative government is resorting to in an effort to thwart and frustrate Sunday's referendum in Catalonia.
Drops are falling from your Spanish eyes. Please don't cry. This is just audios and not goodbye.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Becca Seguin, who's a professor of Iberian Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He has an article at The Nation with Sebastian Faber, "Have Spain and Catalonia Reached a Point of No Return?" Welcome to Background Briefing, Becca Seguin.
Thank you very much.
And it does appear that this referendum on Sunday of a Catalonian independence has it really exhumed the ghosts of the past in terms of the Spanish Civil War and all of the unresolved issues that still haunt that country?
Well, I'd say that it's stirred up a lot of those issues that have been latent for the past 40 or so years since the transition to democracy in Spain happened after Franco's death in 1975. And that's because Spain is it's a peculiar country in that Spain has many languages that are spoken in the peninsula. And among those is, of course, Catalan. And then you have Basque, you have Galician, you have also various kind of dialects of Catalan, which are spoken in Valencia. And so there are lots of kind of regional variations to that. And those were suppressed for a long time during the Francoist dictatorship, which began technically in 1939 after Franco basically conquered the entire peninsula. And Barcelona was, of course, one of the last bastions of democracy at that time. And it lasted all the way until his death in 1975. And some would even suggest that the transition to democracy was not really completed until the 80s. And so during that time, Franco, of course, outlawed the speaking of any kind of other language that wasn't Castilian, which is basically Spanish, right? And so because of that, there are lots of people in the Basque Country, in Catalonia, and elsewhere had to or wanted to preserve not only a language but also a culture, and they had to do so clandestinely during that time. And now I'd say that the Spanish state, though I want to make clear that it hasn't become a fascist state again, it's not authoritarian, but is certainly using tactics that have reminded many people of the repression during the Francoist years. So, for example, in the past couple of days, the government announced and has been sending 7,000 police and both local and national police to Catalonia just to enforce the illegality of the referendum vote, and that has struck many people, including myself, as not only disproportionate, but of having echoes of the past.
Explain what you mean when you say force the illegality vote.
So, in early September, Catalonia formally announced a referendum that will happen, is scheduled to happen on October 1st. And so they passed a series of laws that through the Catalan Parliament that announced this vote. And then, of course, the central government immediately repealed it or immediately called for its repeal and presented its case to the Spanish national courts, when the Spanish national courts then issued kind of decrees as to what to do, how they declared this, or they suspended the referendum officially so that they could look into the legality of the referendum. And then they issued a series of demands as to how to, or a series of instructions rather, as to how to go about in enforcing that this referendum not take place, right? So one of the problems with that, of course, is that the Spanish government, which is currently ruled by the conservative Partido Popular, the PP as it's known, went to a very particular judge who has a long track record of being very conservative, a kind of Antonin Scalia, if you will, of the Spanish national courts. And he issued some very kind of harsh and direct statements as to how they should proceed. And the government, I believe, has even interpreted those rather liberally. The government, just to give you a series of examples, the government has not only sent in police force, but it invaded several print shops. It shut down websites. And one of the most threatening things that it did, apart from the police, was it rounded up 14 members of the kind of cabinet officials, I guess you would say, who were preparing this vote, and arrested them. And then a few days later released them, but still fined them between $7,000 and $14,000 each day that they would proceed to work on preparing the referendum for October 1st. And on top of that, it also threatened many media organizations by saying if you were running ads and presumably even content that suggests that you were that could be construed as being in favor of the referendum, you were by extension being an accomplice to something that was illegal, and therefore the government would hunt you down and fine you, if not shutter your media organization altogether. And so those kinds of threats have been building basically since September 6th and September 7th, when the Catalan Parliament passed these laws in order to make the referendum kind of official in Catalonia.
And again, I'm speaking with Becca Seguin, who is a professor of Iberian Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He has an article at The Nation with Sebastian Faber, "Have Spain and Catalonia Reached a Point of No Return?" So the leader of Catalonia, Carlos Puigdemont, he's threatening now to be barred from politics and to go to prison for misusing the public money to hold this referendum. That, of course, is a part of the order that you just mentioned from the Spanish High Court from its most conservative judge. I mean, I can't see them stopping it. I know Rajoy was at the White House recently with Trump, and Trump, of course, weighed in. I don't think he knew what he was talking about, but he was obviously against the referendum. Putin, by the way, is for it. I don't know. You're welcome to discuss that if you like. But it would seem to me that with all the attention around for the press around the world, and with all of the fervor, people are going to take to the streets on Sunday, and aren't they going to defy the government in Madrid?
So that's a really important question as to how they will be able to take the streets. I believe that I agree. I think that that many people will turn out. If there are polling stations available, and of course that's one of the things that the Spanish central government has spent the past 3 weeks trying to do is basically sniff out any polling station to make sure that they won't be available. But if there are, I believe that people will come out and vote. And one of the things that Sebastian and I found in our reporting is that the tides are turning even further toward the yes vote, toward the pro-independence vote. Just in the past few weeks and even in the past few days. So why is this? Well, most people in Catalonia, I think, would in general not be in favor of a referendum. But as people like the Barcelona mayor, Ada Colau, have stated, they see many people have turned to see this referendum as not necessarily a pro-independence and anti-independence vote, a decision on sovereignty, but more as an affront to the conservative government of the Partido Popular, who basically, since they came to office in 2011, have installed a very draconian kind of austerity measures and even curbed freedom of expression. So a few years ago, they passed a law that was termed the gag law by many critics, including myself, where they limited the right of photojournalists and journalists in general in covering protests, and especially in covering the police and police violence and police brutality against protesters. And so I think that people have come to see this referendum vote more as a kind of, you could call, a march against or a protest against the government itself. And I think because of that, lots of people will turn out if they can. Now, one of the things that me and many people I believe are worried about is what kind of violence will ensue if those 7,000 police officers clash with people who are trying to get to polling stations, or with people who are just trying to show their disagreement with the policies of the central government. I fear that this might lead to some kind of at least immediate violence in the hours and maybe even days after the referendum vote.
So in terms of the political passions here and the motivations, there is this sense of how regional languages and cultures have been suppressed by Franco and throughout the dictatorship, which was quite brutal. I remember being in Barcelona during that period when Franco was the dictator and the Guardia Civil were everywhere. I was actually in a bookstore in Barcelona and young right-wing thugs came in and threw ink all over the books of Jean-Paul Sartre and others, you know. I mean, it was like a flashback to the 1930s. I felt like I was trapped in some peculiar political anachronism. It was a really shocking display. But in any case, isn't there also the other factor of just how much youth unemployment there is and how this conservative government, through its austerity, has really angered the young and punished the poor?
Yeah, I'd say that definitely has a lot to do with it. And in fact, if you want to date this kind of surge in pro-independence sentiment within Catalonia, you can start very well with either the date 2010 or 2006, if you want to stretch it a little further, which is when a vast number of people in the political elites in Catalonia kind of turned on the question of whether Catalonia should be an independent nation. So the previous leader of what would be the ruling party in Catalonia, which is actually a coalition between a center left and a center right party. The previous leader was Artur Mas, and Artur Mas, back before 2010, was like many center right people in Catalan politics, was not in favor of independence. In fact, he was in favor more of kind of a negotiation, a constant negotiation with the central government over more degrees of autonomy, so especially over language, culture, and definitely economics, right? So Catalonia and Barcelona especially are one of the major financial centers of Spain. And so in 2010, Artur Mas had a kind of change of heart, one could say. And in the ensuing years, he basically through kind of mass demonstrations and through convincing the people in his party, turned a significant amount of Catalans into pro-independence nationalists. And now Artur Mas, of course, this has a checkered history, and his party definitely has a checkered history. So the previous leader of that party was a man named Jordi Pujol, who was recently indicted on various kinds of criminal activities that he was, financial criminal activities he conducted while leader of the Convergencia party, which was the previous party of Carlos Puigdemont, the current leader in Catalonia. And so this change of heart, which, as we mentioned in the article, was just written about by the New York Times reporter Rafael Minder, this change of heart is very recent and has only grown. And basically the argument goes that Catalans not only have a linguistic and cultural difference with the rest of Spain, but also they're paying more into the Spanish coffers and not receiving their fair share of the economy, right? So as we mentioned in the article, I think Catalans pay something like 20% of the overall budget basically comes from Catalonia of Spain, but yet they only receive back something on the order of 16%. And this argument has really convinced, I think, many people that this is not only a question of identity, but it's also a question of economics. Now, Artur Mas, I think, has construed his argument in a very fishy way, right? Because, of course, Artur Mas, as we also mentioned in the article, was one of the people who installed austerity measures in Catalonia, and perhaps even more forcefully than the Partido Popular did in the rest of Spain. So he is very much a guilty party in this, even though some minority of Catalans don't want to buy that argument. But there is also a left-wing argument for Catalonia that depends entirely on economics and is, at least by their own telling, not an identity movement at all. And this would be basically the idea that the creation of a new Catalan state would create at least the opportunity to refound an economic system that would be more distributive, would have a more solid base in the welfare state, which, of course, has been eroded with the punitive austerity measures that Mas and Rajoy and other other elite politicians have imposed since 2011. And so that this opportunity would at least afford a large swath of Catalans the chance to kind of remake a state in their own image. And now, of course, these two ideologies, one could say, are clashing right now. Have clashed in the past, but right now are being kind of held in suspense until after the independence movement moves forward and declares independence. And then, the idea goes, they will kind of dissolve into their factions again and then try to wrest power from each other and found this state. Now, who has more support? That's an important question. Again, like I mentioned, there's a coalition government between the center-left and the center-right. One could call it a grand coalition in Catalonia. And it has yet to be seen how cozy they will be toward one another if a referendum vote goes through, if that referendum vote is in the majority, yes, and if they're able to found a new independent Catalan nation.
Well, it does seem that Podemos, which was a new political movement, has lost some of its steam. So it seems like the fissure between nationalism and independence on the one hand and economic justice on the other is being exploited by the conservatives. So am I correct in that analysis?
I'd say that it hasn't lost its steam so much as it's been kind of split down the middle.
Right.
So Podemos and kind of other people on the left elsewhere in Spain have this idea that the referendum should be a kind of pact referendum, that there should be an agreement between the central government and Catalonia to have a legally binding referendum that would be respected on both sides. But many people on the left in Catalonia they see that as a contradiction in terms. They say, well, how are we going to vote legitimately on independence when the person or the people that we would be separating from has veto power over that vote? In other words, they would be entering into this negotiation and could say, well, actually, we don't want to reach an agreement, which is effectively what the Rajoy government has done without even entering into any kind of negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
And so they see this as a contradiction in terms that you cannot kind of overcome. And so there's a split between, I'd say, people on the left in many other parts of Spain versus people on the left in Catalonia, where the Catalans think that this is a contradiction, and people elsewhere think, well, there should be a vote, certainly, but it should be a binding vote that is respected on both sides. And I'd say that is split. Podemos, for example, right down the middle, the Catalan branch is very furious with the central kind of Madrid hub of the party. And this is also true, for example, to a lesser degree, with the PSOE, the Partido Socialista, the Socialist Party, and the Socialist Party's branch in Catalonia, which has always been, one could say, more progressive and or at least less oriented toward the central government than its sister in Madrid.
Well, Becca Seguin, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Becca Seguin, who's a professor of Iberian Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and he has an article at The Nation with Sebastian Faber, Have Spain and Catalonia Reached a Point of No Return? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.